Radio.
Howdy, partners, and welcome here to I Just Want to Talk About Star Trek World. Giddy up, everybody. Grab yourself some earbuds, place some in, and follow me, a robotic simulation of Mike McCafferty, into a world where there are no consequences. And if you don't like it, just blow me up, and I come back the next day. I'm the real Mike McCafferty. I'm not a robot, at least as far as I know. And I just want to talk about Star Trek most of the time. Tonight, I need to deviate for a little bit because I'm a little bit irked about something, and I may lose listeners right off the bat, but damn it, I've got to say it. I don't like Westworld.
Are you insane?
They are insane!
In the hands of an adolescent.
It is a cellular peptide cake.
But Matt Frosting.
It does like you.
Mr. Kim.
Hi, Christopher, I'm Nero.
How you doing, Mike?
Here's Spock.
Whoops!
Looks like Sheriff Worf's here to arrest me.
I don't like the HBO series Westworld. I like the movie. The movie's pretty good. But I don't like the series Westworld. Heresy! I just lost 5 listeners probably, right? Go off to your Westworld podcast. I implore you. Saddle up, partner. Get over there. Lickety split. I didn't dig it. Here's the caveat, though. I watched all 10 episodes. Why? Because I was so fascinated by what it is and what it is not. It is so much plot convoluted without any sort of character. We don't care about any characters. Instead, they weave this intricate, Byzantine, ridiculous plot, J.J. Abrams style, keep that in mind with the Star Trek and Star Trek Into Darkness, until finally we get to the very end of the show, and I don't want to spoil too much of it, but it's a mystery. And it keeps on being a mystery. This is the guy who made Lost. It shouldn't be a mystery that there's more mystery. A lot of the things I don't like about it are the antithesis of what makes Star Trek so great. And yet I watched it. I watched all 10 episodes because it was like this beautiful golden train that was coming into the station. Everyone watched, look at that golden train. It's so beautiful. Oh, there are robots on. There's Ed Harris in it. And look, Anthony Hopkins. Sir Anthony Hopkins is driving the train. Woo, woo. Look, here it comes. And it's made of gold. It's beautiful, but it's going 150 miles an hour. And it doesn't quite know where it's coming from, doesn't quite know where it's going to, but there's a giant brick wall, and it won't stop, and we all watch it crash into a billion pieces that add up to nothing. Thus ends my diatribe about Westworld. So I've been sort of irked by Westworld. A lot of my friends have had similar thoughts about this, and I thought, well, let me go ahead and put it in through the Star Trek lens, as I must do for all these things. And I realized, well, the first thing I want to do is I wanted to look at it through the idea of how they deal with artificial intelligence and robotics in Star Trek, because I think they do a much better job, at least in the Next Generation, and then beyond. With Next Generation, they do a really great job with robots, with Data, and then beyond that, they do a great job with artificial intelligence and the cybernetics with Seven of Nine, with the Doctor, not the Kim Miller Doctor. She's not going to be here tonight. She's going to be on a plane tomorrow to Paris to celebrate her birthday, my birthday. And it's a big one. She's turning 95. So basically, I wanted to look at it through the eyes of how Star Trek does a better job of handling our interaction with the coming AI revolution. But before I did that, I realized, wait a minute, I'm missing something, because Star Trek also dealt with the Wild West. In 2 specific episodes, Star Trek dealt with the Wild West in the TOS season 3, Spectre of the Gun, and in the season 6, TNG, A Fistful of Datas. So I thought, well, let's start with that. Let's go with that. So I watched both of these episodes, and fascinatingly enough, what I thought I was going to discover from those was dramatically different. My expectations were much, much different. Much the way my expectations for Westworld were dashed. I know. Everyone likes Westworld. I get it. I can't go too deep into it. Maybe I'll have like a separate little shuttlecraft podcast where I talk about all my issues with Westworld. Maybe I'm wrong. I'm probably 100% wrong. But I'm 100% right about these 2 episodes of Star Trek. And so tonight, partners, we're going to saddle up. We're going to talk about Spectre of the Gun and Fistful of Datas, and maybe relate it a little bit to Westworld. And in order to do that, I'm going to call, I'm going to talk to Jason Mekaris, my friend, Jason Mekaris, who is something of a Westworld apologist. He likes it more than I do. We watched the season finale together at his house. Not the two of us alone. He has a wife. I have a wife. It's all good. But with a little party, and at the end of the finale, we all just sort of sat there quietly and said, huh, well, how about that? But he just watched Fistful of Data for the first time and Spectre of the Gun for the first time. So I'm going to talk to him. We're going to figure out if Westworld or Spectre of the Gun or Fistful of Data, we're going to have like a three-way fight. We're going to have a three-way. This is getting weird. We're going to have a three-way, and we're going to figure out what we think about all of these shows. Let's talk. All right. I am here with my good friend, my friend, Jason Mekaris. How are you, sir?
Oh, indeed. I'm well, thank you. I'm well. I'm happy to be here. I don't know. Is this the first time that we've ever done a two-way pod just ourselves without the doctor? I know the doctor's done one without me.
Yes. She's earned her stripes over many years. I won't say how many years because her birthday's coming up.
Yeah, I know. You were about to reveal all the secrets.
the big secret. She's 23.
We're all decaying.
The deadly years. Oh my gosh.
Absolutely. Of course, she's a diehard Star Trek fan for many, many years.
Yes, but you are coming on very quickly, coming on to me very quickly, and it's really it's been really weird.
We're going to talk about that, Mike.
Yeah, I know. Let's just broach this right now. No, you. So if you don't know, Jason Mekaris has been my friend for 16 or 17 years now, and very much not on board with Star Trek.
Correct.
But thanks to this podcast, I have reeled him in and forced him to watch the first 1.5 seasons of Star Trek.
Correct.
How far are you?
I'm 1.5 seasons in.
What's the last episode you've seen besides Spectre of the Gun?
What was the last episode? I'm sorry. I have to briefly pause here for a moment.
That's all right. You know, this episode is brought to you by
Woken the Woman.
I guess. I don't know. I'm supposed to say something. Check out the I Just Want to Talk About Star Trek Facebook page. And if you want to hear something, go to my Twitter, @ Mike McCafferty. I've got some good discussions with people there. All right. Do you know which one it is now, Jason? I'm all out of discussion there. Go to Amazon, MeUndies, Feral Audio, Dan Harmon, whatever.
Sorry about that.
All right. Where'd
you last leave off? It's all fine now. That's a good question. You know, I should pull up the episode list here. So
I thought you were doing that. I was stalling for you, and then you...
I don't know. I was trying to get out of trouble because I'm keeping my wife awake. I don't have a man cave like you.
Oh, no. Oh, dear. Did you anger her? Did Vol summon you? What's going on here?
Well, less anger, more frustration. Oh, I can't sleep. I'm like, oh, okay. Well, I'll keep it down.
All right. These are the problems that we run into. All right. So we'll put a pin in that and let's talk about this. So the reason, first of all, Kim, she's going off to Paris. We'll always have Paris. That's an episode of Next Generation. So I'm talking with Jason because Jason, in addition to following up on Star Trek, is a little bit of a Westworld apologist. Is this correct?
Oh, I don't know about apologist. I enjoy the show. I'm not going to say it is terrible like you do.
All right. Okay.
So it's certainly flawed. There, it's not a perfect show, but I enjoyed it very much. I thought it was very entertaining.
All right. Well, see, there's already a problem. So this is perfect. Yeah. This is perfect because I had Jason watch The Spectre of the Gun and Fistful of Data's, which both are infinitely better than a million Westworlds. Is that right, Jason?
Oh, that's not even close to being true.
A billion. Oh, gosh. You love that. I know you love these.
Behind the scenes, you revealed to me last night that you watched these episodes again yesterday. And you're like, oh, wait a minute. They weren't quite as good as I remembered them.
Well, now, hold on. I watched A Fistful of Data's before I talked to you. And I watched Spectre of the Gun after I talked to you. So let's jump into Fistful of Data's first.
Sure. Which is interesting for me because I really haven't seen much Next Generation except for the episode we watched when we were in San Diego. What's the title of that one?
Conspiracy. We watched Conspiracy. One of my
favorite episodes.
So bad. It's so good.
Yeah.
Okay, yeah. So you've only
so watched... we watched Conspiracy. That's it. I've seen a couple of episodes, you know, back in the 90s.
Right.
I wasn't an avid viewer or anything, but, you know, I'd seen a couple episodes here and there. But so this was kind of like one of my first forays into watching a full episode of Next Gen. And, yeah, so it was interesting.
It was. So let's take you off the Enterprise, put you in a holodeck in the Wild West, and have you make sense of what's going on. Is that what I just did?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I knew it was going on, but at the same time, you know, it was... Maybe I'm expecting that's probably not their finest episode.
That is an understatement. Yes, it is. It is a. all right. So let's give you guys a little bit of background. Fistful of Data is a sixth season episode. It is set primarily in the holodeck with Worf and his son, Alexander, already a red flag. And Deanna Troi.
Yeah, does Alexander pop up quite a lot in the series or no?
Only when the show's going really good, they need to slow it down a little bit. Only when the show's really hitting its stride. No, I shouldn't say that. I mean, there are some people I'm sure who love Alexander, and we will find them someday. They are. No, he was a weird character who popped up with a really great subplot of Worf, like, having a relationship with his Klingon woman, and then, like, all of a sudden, he pops up. And then for a little while, like he's like Alexander's with Worf, and then he kind of like banishes him to Earth with his, you know, his grandparents, just because the writers didn't know what to do with him. And then he comes back, and it's just a big mess. Star Trek: Next Generation did not know how to deal with children very well. Rascals is another. so you have those three characters.
Kind of the over. I'm sorry to interrupt. I did enjoy kind of the over top. Relationship, and when he was like, "Saddle up, father," it kind of reminded me of, you know, the old Warner Brothers cartoons. Like, you know, Bugs Bunny Jr.
So this show was early 90s, maybe like 93, I believe, is when it was shot. So it's about, we're talking about the Old West here, and it's interesting because I feel as though the further we start out, like Westworld is so disenfranchised from what Westerns used to be, that it's so disassembled. You know, like their interpretation of what the Wild West is so alien to them and to the viewer that any of the tropes which they're trying to mimic really just kind of fell upon deaf ears. I mean, does that make? I mean, that's kind of my interpretation.
You're saying Westworld's interpretation of the Old West?
Yes. Westworld, as far as like getting back to the old like 50s, 40s through 60s Westerns, which what Westworld was sort of built upon, the original movie and the original idea was that you can go back to the Wild West, the cool Wild West, not like the Deadwood, like, you know, oh, we all have syphilis kind of, you know, Wild West, which is, you know, it can be fun too.
Right.
But experience shootouts and stagecoach robberies and Native American attacks and all that sort of stuff, you know, politically incorrect as it may be, all that sort of
stuff. Sort of a Hollywood version, a glamorized version of what the Old West was as opposed to a reality.
Exactly. And so when we visit Star Trek Next Generation here with Fistful of Data's, it's in the 90s. And really that second rebirth of Western hasn't really happened as much. You have, you know, movies like Silverado and Pale Rider and stuff like that. But really, you know, and you know, Back to the Future 3, of course, it's a very postmodern look at Western.
I thought you were going with like Unforgiven and sort of the comeback of the Western. Well, Unforgiven, Clint Eastwood.
Well, Unforgiven.
That was 90s. Yeah.
Was that 90s? Was that what? I don't even know when that was. Was that early 90s or late 90s?
I want to say it was mid early, but I could be wrong about that.
I'll
investigate it.
Yeah, it's so.
But go ahead.
But even with that, it's still like one, you know, one data point.
It was 92.
In
1992. But yeah, I felt like at least from my memory, that was kind of like there weren't very many Westerns at the time, at least serious Westerns. Like you're mentioning Back to the Future 3S, you know, not exactly a serious Western in the tradition of Hollywood Westerns. So I thought they considered that a comeback of it a bit when Clint Eastwood won the Academy Award for Unforgiven.
Right. Yeah. And it's a great movie. It is very much a deconstruction of the American Western, you know, as far as like, this is not what the Old West is like. This episode, which is really close to it, you know, as far as timeline, tries to embrace what the Old West is, but it's with people who probably didn't grow up during that time period when the Wild West TV shows were on, you know, and they could really get in those. Right. So anyway, so larger picture, the Enterprise is kind of, they have like a little bit of shore leave. The Bozeman is sitting out, is late to rendezvous them. So everyone has kind of a little day off.
Right.
And we get to see Picard playing his little flute. And what'd you make of that, yes. Jason? Did you understand that at all? Did that make sense to you?
I mean, I didn't really quite get the reference other than the fact that he, you know, maybe has a passion for classical themes. And I didn't know anything about the flute itself, just that he was practicing an instrument. And that seemed very antiquated for that time period in the future.
Okay, so, good.
That kind of ties in with history through Star Trek too. Like, I mean, the original series and everything too. They do mention history and things like that. And I'm thinking of the films too, right? Where Dr. McCoy and Kirk and Khan have that conversation too, don't they? About the birthday thing. And or am I missing something there?
Oh no. You're making good guesses. You're making good guesses. But none of that is actually pertinent to the flute, which is okay. I kind of wanted to see like what you thought about that. I think when you find out what the flute is, it's very cool. But anyways, right now he's playing the flute, which is just kind of okay. So we get kind of a 3-beat joke where everyone comes in and disturbs him.
Interrupts him. Right.
Yep. And then basically Worf is kind of like, he's out of stuff to keep from being with his son.
Right. He's avoiding being with him.
Which, you know, already this is a good 90s show, right? Like, I don't want to be with my son. Like, oh, wow, you're a terrible father. You on every level are a terrible father. You have free time and your son wants to play and you didn't want to play ball. So, he finally relents and goes to this Wild West town. Yes.
In the holodeck.
Yes. In the holodeck. Yes. Yeah. So now you've seen the holodeck before. Is that correct, Jason?
Correct. Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, okay. I don't remember what I've seen happen in the holodeck, but I have seen it before, yeah.
Okay.
I'm familiar with the concept, yeah.
Okay, good. So everybody who's listening right now is going, what the hell's going on? So this is a good way, if you've never watched Star Trek, or if you have watched Star Trek a lot, to kind of get into the mind of someone who's never seen this before, which is Jason. Jason is a fresh mind. And so we're kind of imprinting upon him all these weird episodes.
I'm not of the body.
You're not of the body. Oh, but you're of the body of that, though, Landru. Yeah. All right.
First of all, I... yes.
I'm still tracking that guy down. Lev Mailer. He's still alive, I believe. We're going to find him.
Excellent.
So the holodeck, Jason, is basically... It's the equivalent of... the old Star Trek, when they go to a planet and it's like, you know, gangster world or Roman times, now it's just simulated inside their ship.
Right.
I
guess I've seen them use it for kind of more vacation purposes that were more relaxing, where there was the beach or something like that.
Now, one of the tropes is that, and this is, I think, the fourth time it happens, is that the holodeck inevitably goes wrong. Inevitably, it somehow gets reprogrammed. Right. And it's sort of like our Xbox suddenly, you know, pulling out a gun and like trying to shoot us. You know, it's completely ridiculous,
right.
But it serves its point. This is one of those.
We're closer to having the holodeck now that VR has become such a technological wonder these days. And it does kind of create this idea that you can go places without actually being there.
This is true. Yeah, it is. I mean, The holodeck in Next Generation is, you know, built with like, you know, fields of like hard light or some weird thing like that. But yeah, I mean, it is sort of a weird kind of, it's just magic. It's just magic. I mean, there's a lot of things they don't answer, like how come people can run in two different directions and not like touch the walls. You know, there's all sorts of crazy, weird rules about the holodeck. Because Alexander at one point in time is taken really far away to some sort of mine that Worf can't find him. And the supposedly there's like little treadmill, like force fields that keep you running in place, even though you don't realize it. There's a lot of people.
The way I was envisioning it was, there was that movie. Why am I blanking? It was, I want to say it was another Michael Crichton book with Michael Douglas and, the film was with Michael Douglas and Demi Moore, where I'm pretty sure it was Demi Moore, and the kind of first thing with virtual reality where they were literally looking at files, which is like the most boring thing you can do in virtual reality. It's like, he was on this platform with the headset, and while he was walking, he was just the treadmill would kind of bring him in different directions, which we kind of still see in some of the virtual reality applications now. I don't know if you've seen that, where they kind of strap you in by the waist,
walk
around in circles, and
those are great.
Yeah, so you're not actually going anywhere.
Yeah. And I mean, if you go in like to the Vive, because I, you know, at you know, the stupid buddy, the production company I work at, they have a Vive in a room and they have the little sensors on the walls. And as you go close to the walls, like they have a little grid that shows you where you're at. And that's the other way of doing it, where they actually have the walls. But yeah, I've seen those little things where you're on these little stationary treadmills where you can actually walk. And that's kind of cool too. But for now, the holodeck is just basically magic. It creates an old west world with characters. The computer simulates everything. It's sort of like being in Red Dead Redemption. You know, Red Dead. You know, it's just. I mean, you're there, but you can touch them, and they can, you know, do all sorts of horrible.
Now, would you classify Red Dead Redemption as more of the Hollywood version of the old west, or is that more like the actual old west?
I think it's a middle ground between the old, like, 50s, 60s kind of Western and a little more of the sort of Deadwood-ish kind of vibe, you know? You know, where it's a little... I mean, have you played Red Dead Redemption?
At your place a little bit and at another friend's house, but I've never been through the whole game.
Yeah, it's... I mean, it's fun. It's a lot of fun. It's sort of GTA with horses. It's... you can kind of ride off and do anything you want. And then there's these... It's similar to what Westworld was trying to do, where there are missions where you run into someone's like, hey, come with me and do this thing. You know, you go on these missions, and a lot of them are very tropey. A lot of them are like, you know, you got to, you know, save the girl. You've got to do a gunfight. You have to, you know, stop robbers from this or that. So it's you know, it's fascinating because in both Spectre of the Gun and Fistful of Data's, we are beginning to simulate that. You know, we are beginning to simulate this sort of immersion into the world. And I think both of them touched on interesting parts of it. And I'll get to Spectre of the Gun later. But they're both a billion times better than Westworld. And that's the point I'm trying to make. So,
okay. Well, I'm looking forward to that point being made.
Well, see, Jason, this is like a video game quest. Once you sign off on that, then the quest is over and you can leave the podcast. That's you're trapped in here. You're trapped in this hologram that I've created of a podcast until you agree that Westworld is not that great. So as I was saying, it's interesting because these two shows, you know, which are separated by 25 years and 25 years from now, basically 25 to 50 years from now, have an interesting correlation between video games now. I'll come to that a little later. But the holodeck certainly is becoming very close to VR and these sandbox games. We're closer than I would think that we would be, you know?
Sure. When you're talking about like GTA and that sort of thing, where these open world games. Yeah. Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. So, so let's go into a little more. So we have the holodeck. We're already established with that. And so here we got Worf and Alexander in this kind of West world like place. They go into a bar. Well, first of all, it's an outdoor location, which is different than Spectre of the Gun, which is the weird like sound stage kind of thing. It's on the Universal Studios lot, back lot.
Is it? Okay, cool.
Yeah, and there's one shot, I believe, if you look as they're sort of panning up, they have this interesting crane shot. This was directed by Patrick Stewart too. Where you can sort of see the back lot in the distance. You can kind of see like a weird shed and like, you know, like cars in the background just because it was, you know, shot in 1993. And, you know, there's no, you know, it's like, oh, standard definition. No one will ever see that. And so, you know, 25 years later, I'm looking.
That's funny. Yeah. Well, I mean, I guess part of what the thread that ran through both those episodes for me was, this had to look attractive to the studios budget-wise because they have an old west town, I'm sure, and it didn't take too much to put it all together as opposed to having a battle take place in space or something.
Right. When you have existing sets, you can just go ahead and rent that stuff out. Now, some of the sets look like they were constructed. It looks like some of the interiors, You know, it's hard to tell if some of them were constructed inside the sound stages. So they might have had to pay for that just to make it a little easier. Yeah. But certainly a good portion of it was set outside. Yeah. You know, and that's when you have the interesting thing, if you don't know about how Hollywood works, is that building a set is infinitely more expensive than going to someone's house or some location shooting. It's fascinating. You know, a set, you know, can cost thousands upon thousands of dollars. Whereas if you go to someone's house and rent it out for the day, it maybe costs like, you know, $3,000 to $8,000 to rent for the day. Which is nothing. It's nothing to most.
Actually building a set. Yeah.
Yeah. If you have to build an interior of a house, forget it. You know, it's just so expensive. That's why a lot of commercials will just rent out a house for a day or two, shoot there, and then boom, they're out.
Unless you are able to use that set many, many times, and then it pays for itself.
Correct. Yeah. That's why, I mean, like,
or you happen to have a set like we're discussing, if you already have an Old West set or you have a setting that matches it and it's on the studio lot and you can use it, you know, double it up, then, you know, more power to you.
Right. And this is the trick that that the original series used all the time. That they had, well, we have a gangster backdrop. Well, let's shoot a gangster show. We have all these Roman costumes and Roman sets. Let's use those. You know, they have, you know, Nazi Germany kind of stuff. They would, whatever they had in the back lot is what they would write the show around. And most of the time, Next Generation did not employ that. But this time they said, well, you know, let's go down to Universal Studios and shoot there. So,
right.
Okay. So we've got this Worf and Alexander walking in to this bar and getting this guy.
Right. Worf's about to apprehend him, and he did it the exact wrong way, according to Alexander, right, where he stops him and tells him to do it a different way.
Yeah. So then they make it harder. They increase the difficulty, right, which is interesting. I mean, because, I mean, that's what we do now in video games.
Right.
You know, you can stop the game and you can increase the difficulty, which is something you couldn't do in 1993 necessarily.
Yeah.
You know,
well, I'm sure you could. I mean, even the old video games we'd play on original NES games and stuff like that, they would have like a difficult, medium, low difficulty setting. No,
I don't think they did. I'm pretty sure that's a like the past 15 year kind of thing. Because I can play Skyrim right now. I can pause in the middle of a battle and change it from difficult to easy and kill the dragon. It's so, you know, it's such a cheat. And that's exactly what they do.
Yeah.
You know, in the game, they literally stop the game, make it harder, and then start again.
Yeah.
But it doesn't really seem like it's that much harder, does it? I mean,
well, I guess it depends what you're playing. Sometimes it makes difficulty more. Sometimes they just add more guys if you're playing Halo or something.
But
it doesn't necessarily make the other thing it more difficult or intelligent.
Well, I'm talking about the actual episode where, like, he makes it harder. So,
right,
it just seems like he still fights him, and then they just pull guns, and then Deanna shows up.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah, it didn't really change too much.
Because to your point, I mean, there should have been like 8 more guys. You know, Jesus, this is going to be a real fight. And instead, just like, you know, and then Deanna Troi shows up in all of her stranger, the silent stranger character shows up and makes them go away. Now, this is interesting, too, about this episode is that no one dies in this episode. I don't know if you noticed that.
Yeah.
I mean, this is an episode that has all simulations. It's all just like AI beams of light to look like cowboys, and yet the entire episode has not one fatality.
Yeah, I guess I didn't notice that.
I mean, even think about, there's the final gunfight between like Worf and Data, and what happens? He shoots the gun out of his hand.
Yeah.
And then tells him to leave. And they do.
Which is kind of an old trope of like TV westerns from way back in the 60s, too. Like the good guy wouldn't necessarily shoot the bad guy. They shoot the gun out of his hand.
Well, this,
or the hat off his head.
Yeah. And I guess, I guess that's true. I mean, you know, it certainly does take a lot of the menace out of it, though. You know, I mean,
right.
This episode suffers from some real stakes issue.
Yeah.
You know? I mean, there's really nothing really at stake. I guess they could get hurt.
I mean, that, I guess that was the real stakes for me. And it was, I guess, a little bit tense when the computer simulation wouldn't answer their commands and they're stuck there. And so it seemed like if they were actually stuck there, they could get wounded, killed, whatever.
Yes. And that's, again, that's something like, as you know, when you, you know, when I make you go through all of these Next Generation episodes, you'll see that that's a trope, which is done, even in the movie, even in Star Trek First Contact, they take off all the safety settings so that he can shoot the Borg with a machine gun, which is completely ridiculous as well. But okay. It's just magic. It's like you're going to Hogwarts, like the doors open and you're in Hogwarts. Let's just say that, because it just doesn't make a lot of sense. But this is an oddly nonviolent episode, except for the fact that our heroes are in danger.
Right.
So, because meanwhile, on the Enterprise, you've got all this weird subplot with Data turning into a cowboy.
Right. Because the holodeck has somehow spilled into his brain because Geordi was plugging him into the main computer of the ship, and it's sort of bled into everything else.
Yes, yes. And we have Riker reading a weird poem by Data, which how would he not know that is not the lines?
Right. He hasn't been rehearsing this play at all.
It's like all of a sudden, you know, he's reading like some sort of weird chemical reaction formula. And it's like, oh, it's the lines. I don't know. It's like, are you paying attention to this play? Do you know what's going on?
Yeah. He obviously didn't care too much about the play.
No, he didn't. He didn't. But it kind of serves as a back and forth because this was also an episode. So let me just tell you a little bit about this too, Jason. So you have to kind of dial into this stuff. This is a sixth season.
Okay.
They're kind of going in and out of ideas. They've already done over 100 episodes. They're kind of fishing for stuff. Mm-hmm. And at the same time, Brent Spiner's character is becoming very, very popular. You know, Data,
right.
You know, huge, huge. He's like Mr. Spock. Everyone loves him. And the actor Brent Spiner wants to push and do more and more interesting stuff. Mm-hmm. So they have to find ways to creatively push the boundaries of this character. So why not make him an Old West character? Why not make him all the Old West characters?
Right.
So this episode is very much a romp. Let's let Brent Spiner do whatever he wants. Let's put an Old West and let's have cowboy robots.
Right.
So.
Yeah. Now, was he really as popular on that show as Mr. Spock? You would compare the two? Because,
yeah,
I mean, in the '60s, Mr. Spock was. I mean, there would have been nothing like him on television, and people just freaked out.
That is true. Mr. Spock really. I mean, I wasn't around during the '60s, and neither were you. But I was around during Next Generation, and certainly Data was one of the most interesting characters.
Mm-hmm.
He was not, and it's hard to quantify him as well because he had seven seasons to fully develop, and Spock only had three. Mm-hmm. But I would say he was close to being on par. Mm-hmm. The interesting story is that when he was signed on to do the movie Generations, Brent Spiner, he put a clause in his contract that said he had to act in, they had to put him in two other non-Star Trek movies.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. And so his character, and he had enough clout to go to Paramount and say, I'm not going to do this movie unless you put me in a couple other movies.
And one of them wasn't the remake of 1776?
No, I'm afraid it wasn't. No, he did Independence Day.
Of course, right, as the Doctor.
As the Doctor, and then he did Phenomenon as...
Oh, okay.
The exact same character, pretty much.
I forgot about him in Phenomenon, but yeah, you're right.
Yeah, he's the guy who's jazzed that, you know, John Travolta could move a pen.
Right.
It's all pre-Scientology, right? So it's
right.
So they were really fishing around, and if you watch some of the later seasons, you're going to see that they really try to push the character of Data so the actor Data can have interesting things to do. You know, he becomes an evil robot. It becomes his human creator. He does a lot of different stuff.
Right. Well, it also becomes incumbent on studios to keep their stars happy and give them directing gigs and make them executive producers and things like that as the show continues to go on and they have contract renegotiations.
Exactly. And this, I mean, again, Patrick Stewart's directing this, you know, the show is right. hitting on all cylinders and they got to keep their actors happy. So Patrick Stewart's going to direct this and Brent Spiner's going to play 8 different roles.
Right.
And all of them are going to be not great. I don't know. I guess we could.
It was pretty. I mean, it's funny when you say that because there was that line in the show about every character is turning into data.
Yeah.
Yeah. You guys haven't picked up on that yet?
I know. I shouldn't say he did. He does a fair enough job. He does a fair enough job on playing these. I mean, he does the you know, guy in the jail cell pretty good, and then the bad guy.
Right.
And then he plays that Mexican bandito, and it's like oh boy, we've gone off the rails here, haven't we? This is like a big crazy mustache on him, and
yeah, it was just close enough to being racist that it passed without causing too much trouble.
Well, I looked up that guy playing the bandito because like he did not look Hispanic to me, and I was like, oh, this is the early 90s, maybe he wasn't, but he was. So I mean, at least they were politically correct on that,
right?
Because he was like laughing bandito guy. He's like, hey, right. we got to stop laughing, instant character. So this episode starts filling itself with datas. And they have to finish the mission. Otherwise they're going to be trapped in there. And no one thinks to look for them. It's kind of, if I was in my office for like 15 hours, you know, and my wife didn't come and look for me, I'd be like, well, it's kind of a little weird. Right.
Well, I mean, I guess they were all the episode really does expressly set up in the beginning that they are on break at the moment. They're taking a break. So maybe people wouldn't necessarily be looking for them.
I guess that's true. Yeah. I guess
report for duty. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, people would start looking for them, but since they're all on leave or whatever, and we're taking this break in between while they're supposed to meet up with this ship. I forget what was the deal. It was the Biko.
Not the Bozeman.
Starship Biko.
Yes. Biko Spiko who was that? Peter Gabriel had a song called Biko.
Biko, after Stephen Biko.
Yeah, after Stephen Biko, the South African.
Right, freedom fighter, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So there's a movie Biko, too, I think, isn't there? I think it was.
Yes, yeah. I want to say it was Denzel Washington.
Oh, was it? Biko. Okay.
Yeah.
And you should also, and if you're a listener and if you're a millennial or if you're just a person who wasn't that aware of the 80s or 90s, this is when apartheid in South Africa, the separation of the races was a big deal. And so naming a ship Biko was this sort of kind of interesting homage to what was going on at this point in time.
The film was Cry Freedom, actually.
Cry Freedom.
It was Denzel, directed by Richard Attenborough.
Oh, okay. So there we go. Yeah. All right, so so the datas are piling up. They're piling up, and they have to do something about it. So Worf constructs, and this is interesting. This is one thing I want to kind of bring forth is that this episode has a lot of parallels to Spectre of the Gun, as well, in that they're trapped in this Western world, and the only way they're going to escape is if they complete the mission which has been ordained for them.
Mm-hmm.
Which is that, he has to have this gunfight. And Worf creates with his communicator, which can't communicate out of, it's like my Xbox is not allowing me to make cell phone calls. You know, it has that power. Like, oh, God, yeah. I can't call out now because my Xbox has a gun at me and the doors are locked. better play Grand Theft Auto. But he's able to use it to make a force field.
Yes.
Which is a little kind of, sure, why not? I will turn this cell phone into a force field as well. That's fine. I can do that.
Right.
Everything turns into everything. And it's a weird plan because all it does is it buys him like 15 seconds where their bullets bounce off of him.
Right.
And then what? I guess shoot them, or it's a little mysterious.
Right.
But he manages to shoot the gun out of Evil Data's hand, tells them to leave, and all the banditos leave. You know, they just go. Which seems like they're pretty honorable.
They figured it's kind of futile, so they just gave up.
I guess, yeah. I mean, there's like three of them, and you know, Worf and Troy. So I guess like, well, they got us. We'll just walk away and never come back. You know, I mean,
yeah.
And then Data has to, or then Worf has to be with the girl, who is now Data. In kind of a
right, yeah, I forgot about that. Yes,
yes. And before we get into
big too comedy many, moment,
yes. Before we get into too many shenanigans, you know,
as opposed to all the other big comedy moments where Data is, you know, having awkward walks around the ship.
Yes, yes.
He's bow legged from riding a horse, and he starts having y'all and you know, southern or not southern, but you know, old western. Language kind of dripping into his own.
He spits into an imaginary spittoon.
That's right. Oh God. Yeah. The other thing I wanted to address is too, when Geordi plugs him into the ship, hit the panels on his head. That's like the best way to connect into him.
It's just weird.
This sort of hair panel that flies out of the side and the back of his head.
It's just like this weird USB port in the back of his head, you know. Is that 2.0 or 3.0? I don't know. I mean, yeah. So he has to, in the Enterprise, there's just not that much interesting going on. They're just kind of, you know, oh, Data's got some weird stuff going on with him. We have to purge his brain, and then everything kind of works out. So there's one of the interesting things about Next Generation and a little bit of TOS is that they would have like kind of dual dangers.
Yeah.
You know? I mean, it would make sense. Like, oh, there's a problem on, you know, the holodeck, and there's a problem on the ship, and they're interconnected.
They're connected, right.
Yeah. And here, both of the problems were sort of marginal. You know, they're so like, well, you know, I mean, I guess, I mean, like, Worf and Troy could have just hit out with Alexander, like, in some bushes until someone figured out, you know, that there was, you know, like, hey, well, they haven't reported for a long time.
And those empty barrels outside, saloon.
Jump in some barrels, you know, and like have little hats pop up very comically, and you know, just wait it out instead of deciding they have to go fight this guy, you know, because he has. Well, I guess they stole Alexander, so I guess there was some more of an imperative. So,
right.
So, but there wasn't that kind of complimentary danger on the Enterprise. It was like, oh no, there's cat food in the replicators. Okay, well, shit, you know, what are we gonna do? Very low key threats.
Yes.
So that kind of all goes away, but Worf becomes a slightly better father by promising him emptily, I might add, they never go back to the Old West to have another holodeck adventure.
So I was wondering about that. Would they ever, because even when he was promising him too, I'm like, he's never going to go back there again.
No, they never go back. No, he is just the worst father. You know, he's like, you bet we're going to go to the baseball game, kid. Just keep that glove oiled up. We'll get there someday. And, you know.
But I did find that moment with him and his son at the end to be kind of endearing, and maybe like the one thing about the whole episode where I was like, okay, well that seemed genuine enough to me.
Yeah. Yeah. It had a nice enough payoff, you know, where he does kind of learn like, oh, you know, my son can have some fun things. And if I engage a little more as a father instead of just as like this crazy Klingon who wants to like do maintenance checks on warp coils, you know, I mean, my God.
Right.
You know, it might be better.
And then of course he puts the hat on his head and, you know, he brings out his pretend revolvers.
Right. He's pulled out his finger.
But, the thing was, I noticed in the Old West scenes, it was very unforgiving for the makeup artists, especially with Worf and his son. When you look at the appliances on their faces, it's like so obvious how bad they are. On the ship, it's a little more hidden because of the lighting, and it's a little darker, and you could definitely see. But especially on the sun, you're like, wow.
Yeah.
It just looks like they just slapped this thing on him and put a little makeup on him.
Yeah, that's interesting. What's that?
No, I was just saying that it seemed like they've slapped an appliance on the kid and put a little dark makeup on her. Like, okay, we're good. Good enough.
Right, right. Yeah. No one's going to look at Alexander anyways. It's fine. You know, there's... And then I don't know if you noticed this as well, but again, here's another standard definition versus high definition. but
oh yeah,
with the different data, so they'd have like one data in the foreground, like as the acting data, and then like the data who was in the jail cell was just this dude like painted yellow, basically, who like maybe looked like Data. It just looked like a human being. I don't know if you noticed that, but the high definition was not kind to that.
Oh no, I didn't catch that.
Yeah, it's really funny. If you go back and look as like when they're I'm coming here to see my son, you know, Paul, they did a bad thing for me. Like, I'm gonna get you out, like, you know, like this weird kind of, you know, like Reader's Theater of him acting against himself. But as he walks away, and it's a two shot of Data in the background. It's just obviously this guy who does not look like Data that much. It looks close. They just put him in costume. Because it's standard definition, right? It's like, you know, hey, at 480, we're never going to know.
Well, it's in the great tradition of Star Trek stunt doubles.
It is. It was very, very, very pleasing to me. And then at the very, very end, when it's bad guy Data and his two desperados, it's even worse because they got that same guy and a guy who looks even less like Data, just like some random extra who was walking off the street like, hey, you want to be Data? Sounds good. You know, and they just put these guys in makeup, you know, and just like, you know, slapped a little yellow pancake makeup on them and, you know, sent them out there. So if you want to watch that, that's kind of fun. So overall, Jason,
check that out again.
Overall, what did you think of this episode? Talk to me about this.
It's hard to say, because like I said, I really haven't seen very many episodes of Next Gen. And so, I didn't feel like this was a real strong introduction, for me to watch it. I mean, it was pretty cheesy at times and with all the different datas and especially on the ship with his mannerisms and language and everything. Once he got, you know, misleading programs, but I enjoyed it enough. If I had to compare it to episodes of Westworld, I don't know if I would say it's far better than Westworld.
Okay.
but you know, I we'll get to Spectre of the Gun. I have an appreciation for Spectre of the Gun, but this one is like, it's okay. It's high marks.
I'm going to agree with you on this. I was looking forward to watching this one and being like, all right, Westworld, you're going down. And I was like, ooh, oh, wow. Wow, there's a lot of 90s stuff there that I was not prepared to see. And a lot of the next generation actors just kind of having like playtime. It's a very average episode. It's a very like, well, you know, sixth season. It was a very fan servicey episode, if you want to know the truth. It's like, Data gets to be a cowboy and Picard plays his flute and, you know, Beverly Crusher's doing a play, you know, like everyone. It's one of those things you always want to see as a fan, you know? I mean, it's like, oh, let's watch Luke Skywalker, you know, drink beer. You know, it's like that's one of the things. It's like, you know, I'm trying to make it Star Warsy for you.
That, I want to get that.
See, like, wouldn't you pay like $8 to watch like Luke and Han sit around at a bar for like 30 minutes and just drink beer and just like talk?
We almost get that, though, in Star Wars, you know.
This is true.
They do go to the cantina, even though, you know, they're not drinking the whole time.
This is true. Yeah, but like with no stakes, where you're just sitting around and just like enjoying a beverage with them. And this was very much like, hey, let's give our audience a little bit of fun time. Let's give them a little break. Stakes aren't too tall. You know, it rides off, the ship rides off the sunset. It's all good times. So not a great episode, but still a Western episode. So it fits.
And I would love to kind of get to the point where I understand what you're talking about in terms of Data too, because right now Data to me doesn't seem like that extraordinary a character. I've been familiar with the character for a while, but not, I haven't seen a lot of episodes, like I said, so
yeah,
I don't have the sort of detail that I need to, because right now he just seems like, okay, he's a robot. He kind of looks like a mime.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not quite sure what to make of him other than the fact that he's an android, like what you would see in sort of Alien, or, you know, a humanoid, you know, robot.
Yeah. I think you're going to have to go, you know, maybe someone on Twitter will tweet you. What's your handle, Jason? What's your,
it's just my name @ Jason Makaris. Good luck spelling it.
Yep. M-A-K-I.
But feel free to harass me on Twitter.
Yes. M-A-I-K, no, M-A-K-I-A-R-I-S. I've only known you for 20
M-A-K-I-A-R-I-S,
years.
Yeah.
Jason Mikaris. So maybe give him some pointers on which ones to watch. It is a gradual process where Data turns into something of a weird kind of comic character, Pinocchio, to a much more fully formed character, like in the third, fourth, and fifth season, where you're like, wow, this is a really well-drawn character. And then sixth and seventh, they really start fishing for things for him to do.
Yeah.
And then Star Trek Generations, they kind of jump the shark and give him emotions, and it's like, ooh, boy, that was a mistake. But yeah, he's a character, you know, once you cycle out of the original series, we could either give you like a sampler plate of Next Generation episodes or, you know, have you plow through all of them and see what you think. Yeah. But it's worth watching his development because he has a very interesting development. Okay. But he's a robot. He's a robot in a Western world. So we already have that on the plate, but let's go back 25 years in time.
Okay.
To third season, Star Trek, Spectre of the Gun.
Yes.
Now, we've jumped a little bit ahead of your development.
Right. I had left off at the Apple. So I was just kind of into season two, like five episodes into season two.
That's right.
And so I'm jumping ahead to season three now, which is fine. It was very interesting for me to jump between seasons because, at least to my eye, it seemed like there was a pretty big jump in production value too between like beginning of second season and third season.
Oh, really?
Yeah, to me it just seemed like, I don't know if they had got better camera equipment or what the whole deal was, but it just looked a lot nicer. And it might have just been that, you know, in the restoration for the Blu-rays or whatever. And I should probably ask my friend Ryan, who supervised that. They might have just had better material to work with. The film was probably a little newer. But who knows?
It could be. It could be. I mean, the answer to that is actually they slashed their budgets between second and third season. And they got significantly less money.
Right.
And which is why this episode exists as it exists. And, you know, it's interesting, whereas, you know, where Next Generation and sixth season had so much money they could afford to go on location. You know, I mean, even though it was cheaper than building a whole, you know, soundstage full of stuff, they were able to rent out, you know, the locations. The original series on third season had significantly less money.
Yes.
And so they had to make do with what they had and came up with a very novel solution for this.
Yeah. I guess you could say that. Yeah. I mean, it definitely had artistic merit for sure.
Yeah, there. Yeah, I mean, it. I didn't like this when I watched it as a kid. I was not a big fan of this episode, but I have to tell you, watching it again, I loved it. It was really weird how much I really enjoyed this episode. And so we can maybe kind of go back and forth on that.
Well, I don't know if there's going to be a lot of back and forth because I had an appreciation for it for sure. I mean, it's very obvious, and I was reading in. These are the voyages, kind of the background on the episode. It's very clear that, like you were saying, the budget was absolutely slashed and they just didn't have the money to do a full-on Western. So that's why they have just the facades of the buildings and some of the window frames and things like that. But it also has sort of that Our Town production feel to it. So there's something that's left to the imagination of the viewer.
It's funny you say Our Town because that's exactly what I was thinking as I was watching it today. Yeah. I was like, this is very Our Town. Let me go back and give a quick recap for those people who have not watched Spectre of the Gun. Actually, watch Spectre of the Gun before you listen to the rest of this because I think you need to because otherwise it's a bit of a spoiler, but I think it's a good – it's a really good episode and the way it reveals everything is done in a fairly nice way. Okay. Those people are gone. So the Enterprise is going, they're exploring space and there are these Melkoshians they have to talk to with this weird probe, which tells everybody to go away.
Yes, the Melkoshians.
The Melkoshians, they ignore that. They fly right past this weird, you know, spinning space station that says go away.
Right.
The Melkoshians show up, look like big brains with eyes. And say, you guys have trespassed on here, so we're going to kill you. Always a good way to, you know, always a good way to start a relationship. And probe Kirk's mind for the way to kill them. And the way they do it is by deciding that they're going to kill him by and like, you know, the crew members who beam down by putting them in an Old West town.
Right.
But the conceit
is not just any Old West town.
Oh, yeah. Tombstone, Arizona. Tombstone. Place right. of the Clantons and the Earps fighting on the very right. day where they had the big gunfight at the OK Corral. Is that it? Or is, yeah, that's it. The OK Corral.
I think so. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. So the big yep. gunfight at the OK Corral, which I guess Kirk was thinking about. We don't, there's never any reference right. to him thinking about the Old West. But.
Well, yeah, he, and both, well, I guess, and Spock mentions too that he has meticulously studied human history. So he has this knowledge, which you can kind of buy. Sure. But Kirk really seemed to have this in-depth knowledge of it all too.
Yeah. You know, I've been thinking a lot about the War of 1812, Jason. And yeah. Oh, my God, look. We're...
I just so happen to have studied it for several years.
If the Melkosians tried to kill us through the War of 1812 through my memory, I don't know what – it would just be like a blank space with the big numbers 1812. That's all I know. And maybe like a couple of like British people running at me. I'd be like, well, okay. They take his memories, but because his memories are incomplete – you have this really deconstructionist theater kind of thing where there are only like facades, like no buildings are complete. Clocks hang in just like, they just hang like from nothing. There's like the saloon has no walls and the sheriff's office is just one wall that says sheriff on. There's nothing in the back. So it was really sort of this, our town is very apropos because it is this very deconstructed set, very representational, not presentational, I guess.
Right. So it did give you the idea of the locations, but I guess without the specific, I mean, it did give you, to me, it gave not only the impression of what was there, but I kind of filled in the blanks in my head, I guess.
Yeah. I think it was, I mean, it was just enough information to know where you were.
Yeah.
You know, and that's what theater does all the time. I mean, theater has like one wall and you're fine with it, you know? Yeah. But and like I said, when
the one wall,
the one, yeah.
The mythical one, the fourth wall doesn't exist. It's just the one wall.
Yes. There's the fourth wall. And then there's the one wall of Star Trek third season where they just don't have the money to build the sets. So they just get whatever sets they found from Gunsmoke that were like laying in storage and put them up and said, sheriff's right. office. But under the context of the way the Melkosians set it up, it kind of works.
Well, we didn't talk about too when you mentioned that the Melkosians, you know, address them and tell them that they're destined to, you know, go to this place where they're going to. I guess they don't really reveal that they're going to kill them until they're actually down there, right?
No, they because what happens is Kirk kind of doesn't listen to their warning. They go there. This is another weird conceit where it's like, well, Starfleet really wants us to go there, so let's go past this warning. They beam down there, and the right. Melkosians are pissed, and they're like, okay, we're going to kill you by your own brain thoughts.
But the point I wanted to get to was when we actually see the person who's threatening them, it's this large papier-mâché dragon guy with red eyes.
Right.
You know what I'm talking about?
It's a big floating brain. Yeah, it looks like a big floating yeah. brain with eyes. Yeah.
Yeah. It kind of reminded me of the puppet from the Clint Howard episode.
Yes, it's very Baylock. Bit. Yeah, very
yes.
very Baylock puppet kind of thing. Because, yeah, I would completely buy into that because it has that similar sort of, you know, because the Baylock puppet was all through like the wavy lines and you can't get a good look right. at it. And it just, yeah, it wasn't the best effect, but it was, you know, creepy enough, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, it could have just been a dude. It could have been like, hey, I'm a Melkosian. I'm going to, you know, put you in the Wild West. So at least they tried something.
Yeah.
Maybe
they... Was that an actual Melkosian or was that sort of like a warning guy?
I think that was an actual Melkosian because at the end of the episode, he shows up again like in outer space, like on their view screen. It's like, okay, right. come on down. Yeah. And then we never, ever hear from these guys again. All they can do is make you see incredibly weird, vivid things, and we'll never see them again. So, you know.
Right.
Probably because they look so weird. Just big floating brains. But I dug this episode a lot more than I remembered. Because we're kind of recanting what was going on. The Melkoshians basically put them in Tombstone, Arizona, on the day that the Clantons are shot by the Earps.
Hang on a second. I had to get on my motorcycle.
Gosh. So if you're noticing a subtle drop in quality from Jason's audio, it's because Jason had to vacate his premises just for a little while.
I was keeping my wife up too late, you know, talking about Star Trek.
She's not so up
now
the body.
I'm on the streets.
Yeah, yeah. You know. Jason is wandering the streets looking for a place to
dissatisfaction
stay.
Dissatisfaction with Star Trek by telling me to either wrap it up or move on.
Right. And like a good Trek person he is, he moved on. He didn't wrap it up. Screw that. We got to talk about Spectre of the Gun, damn it.
Yes. Yeah, so I really did enjoy the episode, I have to say. It wasn't. And there were some elements that were kind of funky, you know, the kind of love interest for Chekhov. And I think I had mentioned before, I had a weird sort of problem story-wise with why Chekhov was dead, but then they sort of conveniently just realized, oh, he was alive the whole time because he didn't believe it. But he certainly seemed to believe it as he was being shot.
Yeah, that's a little bit of a... I listened to that part too, and Kirk has a line where he says, you know, he may be dead, he may be alive, we don't know, you know. So there was a weird, there's a weird kind of buy for that where they said, well, maybe he is, maybe he's not. But you're right. Someone else also pointed out the fact that so as they're going on, they build this weird. There's a weird subplot where they build this grenade, this tear gas grenade, which is supposed to knock them out, which is like the most bizarre idea. Like, why don't we build, like, a smoke grenade that will knock them out?
Right.
You know, I can think of, like, 15 other things you could do to not have to fight these guys. Like punch them, you know? I mean, like, so they build this weird baking soda can grenade that doesn't work on Scotty.
Right.
But it makes it kind of weird because it's like, wait, so if Scotty believed that was going to work and it didn't, then how does that work if they don't believe the bullets are real? You know what I mean? It's like, it's...
Right.
Because he believed that it worked and it didn't, so when they don't believe the bullets are real, why don't they just work? You know, I mean, isn't that the reverse of it?
Right.
So a little... Yeah. There's some logic hiccups here.
Yeah.
But I thought still it led up in a weird... Like, the logic that you said is weird that, you know, Chekhov's dead and this thing doesn't work, but the idea that this is all in their mind... And if they can just believe that it's not real, it won't be, is a cool conceit. That's a good science fiction conceit.
Yeah. And I also, I mean, I love the shot too, when I talked about it, when we discussed it, you know, just briefly yesterday, that the shot where they realize that they don't believe that the bullets are real. And then they, well, not the moment, but when they're being shot and you see the back wall being riddled with bullets. I thought that was really great.
Yeah. That probably sold this episode more than anything else. Because otherwise you just have a really kind of low rent 60s, you know, idea. I also have to say one of the other cool things, there are a couple cool things. First of all, the portrayal of all the Wyatt Earp characters, all the Earps.
Yeah.
They're all like, you know, they're all kind of like really robotic. There's almost
could have been twirling their mustaches just a little bit more.
Well, yeah, they're definitely draw. Go on and draw, Jim Kirk. You know, they're very arch with what they're doing. But I love that scene where they're just all standing and waiting for each person to come to them, and then they just walk without turning around. You know, it's a very robotic. It gives you that very distanced feeling, that kind of that you're not, nothing is real here. And then the second thing I love too is as they're walking, as the four Earps are walking and the storm's brewing, is as the lightning hits, and I don't know if you noticed this, but the tree branches, their shadows are hitting like the back, like the back scrim, the back wall of the set. So like the shadows are on the walls basically behind them, which is supposed to be like the sky.
Yeah. Right.
So it's a really weird, it's like you shouldn't see that. That should just be the sky. It should be this weird red alien sky, but all of a sudden the shadows of the trees from the lightning are being shown on that back wall. Nothing is real here. It is like a big set, you know, and it became
Red sky was very cool too. I was doing a little reading about when they shot the episode and everything, and that it was pretty remarkable to me in terms of watching it now. The color was just really cool.
Yeah, they really, because a lot of times, like most of the planets were kind of like blues or greens, but they really made that an angry deep red. And it really kind of played into that alien, you know, production of Our Town kind of thing. Just really kind of painted the setting for us so that we understood that it was just this fever dream of an episode.
Right. I was also just remembering the scene with it was a Kirk and the sheriff where he just puts on that acting clinic extraordinaire where he just loses it.
Oh, yeah. Boy, that guy, he's just, I'll do whatever you want. Kill him. I don't care. Yeah.
But Shatner's just screaming at him. And
oh, yeah.
It's just so huge.
Yeah. And speaking of huge, this is one of the moments where Bill Shatner is at his largest, I think, as far as physical size. I mean, his belly is sticking out, man. He is rolling.
I thought I noticed that.
Yeah. Oh, it's great. Because he wore like one of those little corsets things, but that was not helping, man. There were no melatonin illusions to stop that stomach from protruding out. It was fabulous. I mean, he was, you know, he was living off the third season. He was having a good time.
Well, I'd always heard legend that he was wearing sort of a girdle corset.
Yeah.
But I guess I never couldn't quite tell when it was happening.
Yeah, he was. And then I think I mentioned this before in the podcast, but at some point in time, the producers kind of started noticing him gaining weight. So they cut together all of his dailies showing him at his fattest and they showed him.
Oh God!
Not like saying, "Hey, look how fat you are," but like, "Hey, Bill, come on, we want to show you some dailies." He's like, "Oh, great!" And they showed him like all these unflattering shots of him, like double chins and big bellies. Like, holy shit! So he went out and like went on a crash diet and lost like 15 pounds. No. So
that's just reverse psychology.
Yeah, pretty much.
Yeah, yeah.
So this episode, you know, again, it's kind of twisted around for me, and what started as a bad episode for me 20 years ago, 30 years ago, has now turned into something kind of magical and interesting.
Yeah, like I said, I appreciated it. I liked it a lot, and I had read a little bit of the criticism, and especially in its time, was not very appreciated as an episode.
Yeah.
But I liked it. I liked it.
Well, again, that one, I think it's closest to what a 60s Western was going to be like.
Right.
But because it was so close to it, people couldn't appreciate it. You know, now we can kind of step back and say, oh, wow, that was really, really great for its time, you know, because it was like an homage and a deconstruction of what a 60s Western was.
Yeah.
And I think now we can watch it. And, you know, honestly, again, you know, as I'm talking about sort of Westworld and video games, this was very much a mission and they had to complete this mission. And these characters, they couldn't break out of their pattern, could they? You know, I mean, who am I? Well, you're Ike Clanton. No, look at me. Who am I? You're Ike Clanton. You know, like, it's like when you're in that video game, you're trying to talk to these characters and you're hitting them, you're staying on their head, you're throwing, you know, baskets on them in Skyrim and nothing works because they just follow a set rule of programming.
It's only the second Skyrim episode, Skyrim reference this episode. So we may have to increase that next episode.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. I'm all, you know, I may play Skyrim after this. I'm very big into Skyrim right now. So.
Well, I know you told me, well, I finally, you know, downloaded it. So I guess I'm going to have to, you know, play.
Oh yeah. Oh, you're going to have to do that. Yeah. And then we'll find a Skyrim episode for, I want to talk about Star Trek. I'll find something there. Maybe Shore Leave or something with the knight.
Are there any medieval Star Trek episodes that I'm about to see?
Not really. Not that I can think of. I mean, there's a Sheriff of Nottingham one coming up in TNG a long ways away, but
okay.
they kind of keep away from a lot of that. I mean, I guess maybe Cat's Paw was close with the wizards, you know, but even that right, was
that's coming up next. I think that's the next episode I'm seeing.
Oh, you haven't seen that one yet. Okay. All right.
No, I still haven't seen Cat's Paw yet.
Okay. Well, yeah, you're in for a treat because that one doesn't make any sense. but there's wizards, so you're going to be okay.
Excellent.
Yeah. It's like shitty Harry Potter. So, all right. So Jason, we've talked about, one good Star Trek Western and one that's of questionable.
Leaves something to be desired.
Yeah. And I have switched around probably 180 degrees from what I thought like 10, 15 years ago about what I thought of these two.
Okay. Yeah.
Now, tell me definitively which one of those is better than Westworld.
Define better.
Well, which one is more satisfying? All right, let me just say this. Were either of those more satisfying to watch than an episode of Westworld? From the component of
I would say possibly, you know, the original series episode was, you know, more enjoyable than some episodes of Westworld that I've seen, for sure. Because, you know, there was a lot of filler in Westworld. There was plenty of episodes where nothing revolutionary happened and you were just kind of confused by the whole thing. And there was no particular explanation. But I think it's also an what's the word I'm looking for? It's a series that's a continuous, story as opposed to episodic, you know, wrapping it up by the end of it. So, you know, they can't necessarily be judged in the same scale, perhaps. But I would say there are certainly episodes. I know what you want to hear is there are certain episodes of Westworld that were not as good as Spectre of the Gun, I would say.
That's exactly what I want to hear, Jason.
Yeah, it's okay. You achieved this victory.
You've reached the center of the maze, Jason. You did it.
Well, yeah. Let's say I have. Because my mission is going to be to get you to append your statement that it's terrible. Because I think terrible should be reserved for actual terrible shows that have no merit or value whatsoever. Because I think there's a lot to that, you know, I admire about Westworld, despite the fact that it's imperfect and, there's it can be irritating at times. But I really do believe it's a pretty good show.
I think it is.
It's not going to be in my pantheon. It's not going to be on my Mount Rushmore of top shows of my lifetime. But, you know, I enjoy it, you know, certainly well enough to have watched the whole thing. And be sort of interested in what happens next season.
I'm going to quote Mr. Spock talking to Trelane, Jason. I've looked up this quote because it's exactly what it encapsulates how I feel about Westworld. Mr. Spock says, "I object to you. I object to intellect without discipline. I object to power without constructive purpose." That's what I think Westworld is. I think it is intellect without discipline, power without constructive purpose. I think it's a lot of money being thrown at a Western idea, which is not working and has no exit and didn't know how to get into its own entrance. I don't think it knows what it's doing. So,
I just think you're looking at it from the wrong perspective because twice tonight you've mentioned it as a show of a Western theme and based on Western ideas and everything, and I really don't think that's what it is. I think it's a sci-fi show with a facade of a Western fantasy island, but you know there's really not a lot of validity to the old West themes in it.
Well, we're looking at it through the Western aspect of Star Trek.
Oh, of course, for our episode. Yes.
Yeah. We'll get to the whole robots and AI and whatever the hell they're doing over there. We'll destroy them on that side. But right now, I just want to get to the Western. So
yeah, I hope we can talk about the potential reasons why robots might have sex in a burning tent in that episode.
Oh boy. Oh boy.
Because there actually is a reason, and I didn't realize it.
Yeah, I know what the reason.
In that episode.
Yeah, I know what the reason is. But did Ike? I mean, did Wyatt Earp or Doc Holliday in that episode ever like talk about their feelings or kill flies or make love to each other in like the burning facade of the barber office? I mean, no, they did not.
It may have happened. We may just not have seen it.
Is that did fist off camera? Did all the Datas get together and try to find a mysterious way out of wherever the hell town they were in?
How do you think all those Datas came to be? Obviously, a few of those Datas were having sex with each other and burning tents.
Yes, they were. Oh, my goodness. I'm trapped again in this facade of a sci-fi show called Westworld. Westworld is terrible, Jason.
I disagree.
I will edit that around so it makes it sound like you're saying I agree. I can do anything. I'm the Maeve of the show. I have unlimited intelligence. I am impervious.
You're the Ford of this show.
Cease all motor functions, Jason. Listen to me. I'm going to reestablish an analysis. Why do you think it's a good show?
What is the difference between cease motor functions and computer stop simulation or whatever, you know, Worf said during that episode that didn't work? I think that episode is a good example of why it's the exact same thing.
Maybe you're
absolutely right. Maybe Westworld has completely ripped off Star Trek The Next Generation, not even the original series.
Well, I mean, since Westworld was before Star Trek Next Generation, I guess we can kind of chicken and egg this.
That's a good point.
But the trope of robots going mad is such a long-standing one. And
yes,
in The Next Generation, it wasn't robots going wrong. It was the holodeck always going wrong. It sort of supplanted the idea that robots were evil or whatever. And it was always the holodeck which had somehow gone askew. So,
right. But I don't think it's fair to judge a show based on previous material of different, of the genre that's happened before. I mean, there's been a million, movies and TV shows about robot uprising. And I mean, it's not a shock that it happened in this one. I think we all knew that's what it was coming to.
It's not a shock. It's just that they've handled it every single beat of it so poorly, especially when they have reference points like Next Generation or even the original series or any science fiction show which depicts robots and artificial intelligence.
Well, so you're saying that they should, use those as a basis for this? Isn't that the cause of? I guess I could argue that most, even great art, is somewhat borrowed. There's something that's familiar and something that's original about it.
Yes.
So I can understand you saying that, but at the same time, it's like, well, if you're going to do something that's going to, follow that particular genre, but doesn't necessarily have to own certain aspects of it. I don't think you can criticize it for that, because these shows did it better, and so you should emulate what they did. I mean, I don't know.
I know what you're saying, and in the coming weeks and months, I'll show you why it's wrong via Star Trek, via Data, and via the Doctor from Voyager. We're gonna go all through this, and by the time you're done, you will say these words.
Not
Dr. Bashir. Although he has his own secrets.
I'm just waiting to reach my Star Trek apex where I get to Dr. Bashir.
Oh, well, you're going to get to Dr. Bashir, but then you have to skip over that to get to Voyager to see how they handle AI, basically.
Okay.
Dr. Bashir, he's got his own secrets. And then Dr. Bashir.
I only know him from Game of Thrones.
He does die in Game of Thrones. I don't want to spoil it for everybody, but he does. Yeah, Dr. Bashir. Bashir.
Just ruined that entire series for people.
But it's all a hologram. It's all a simulation. It's all a Westworld world. It's all Game of Thrones land.
Oh, well, that would make Westworld worthwhile if it was just, a top level for, Game of Thrones.
When you
get to the medieval world and it turns out to be Game of Thrones, it's all one big series.
See, I would watch that. I would watch where people go into a Game of Thrones robot world and watch that,
No, it's just that the entire Game of Thrones series has been robots and we didn't know it.
Oh, I'd watch that too.
Westworld, yeah.
See, I'd watch that too. If it was just Game of Robots, I would be 100% on board with that. But it's okay. It's a Game of Thrones is coming back. If you want to listen to our, we have a podcast called, I just want to, what is it called? It's called HodorCast. Yeah,
I just want to talk about HodorCast.
Yeah, we should.
It's called HodorCast.
It's called HodorCast.
And Hodor was actually DJing the Critics' Choice Awards tonight, if you were watching on A&E and the after party.
Oh, God.
So our friend Nancy Fang was going to try and get him to appear on HodorCast. Who knows if that's going to actually happen or not. But
oh,
it would be very entertaining if we could somehow get Hodor appear on the podcast of his, you know, namesake.
His eponymous podcast here.
Yes.
Have him show up to that. Yeah. Well, we've run
we're
out
ways
of,
off from that, though. Game of Thrones is like, what, next summer or something like that?
Oh, yeah. It's so far away. Ugh. I guess I have to watch The Man in the High Castle or something.
I have not seen that show yet. I haven't seen that or what's the Black Mirror? Is that the show?
Black Mirror. That's okay.
Yeah, I haven't seen Black Mirror yet.
3% is pretty good. I watched the 3% on Netflix. I like that.
All right.
Watch The Man in High Castle, and then we'll do the Nazi episodes of Star Trek, because there's one.
Excellent.
Yeah, there's one on. The original series, and then there's, I think, a two-parter on Enterprise, so we'll watch that.
Okay, sounds good.
All right. Well, Jason, thanks for joining me here. Thanks for...
Yes, thank you for, having me on and allowing me to be in two different places during one podcast.
Yeah, you were quantum on that.
I'm going to have to board my motorcycle here at the end,
right
off the
sunset. And, you know, did you notice there were no horses in either of those episodes?
Oh, yeah. No horses.
Horses are expensive. You got to go horse wrangler. Couldn't afford it.
Yeah.
So just the horseless towns. All right, friend. Well, thank you for talking to me. I'm just going to say, I'm Mike McCafferty.
And I'm Jason McCarris.
And I just want to talk about...
Star Trek!
Error, flaw, imperfection.
When the train comes in, everybody rides.
Blah, 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 blah,
blah. No, blah, blah, blah!
Your daddy can put them up. Can he? Can he? Can he? Can he? Can he?
Hello, I'm Kyle Ayers. I'm the host of Never Seen It, the podcast where comedians rewrite famous movies and TV shows they've never seen, and then we give them a read in studio. This is a clip I want to play for you guys from an episode where Langston Kerman rewrites Scarface. He's never seen it, but he wrote a script based on what he thinks he knows about it, and here's a clip. Give it a listen.
All right, Scarface, The New Frontier. Interior, happening discotheque. Remember when we called clubs discotheques? LOL, the 70s were crazy. Night. The crowd bustles with young, hot Mexicans who are supposed to be Cuban and all are dressed in butterfly collared shirts and pants that look like JNCO jeans and pleated khakis had a really weird baby. There's sex in the air and Poppy wants a whiff.
Oh my God.
Scarface, 22 to 45.
Like he's a television audience demographic.
Devilishly handsome. Not even a little bit Italian looking, so get that out of your dumb brain. Walks through the crowd with the confidence of a man who's going on MTV Cribs with the Ying Yang Twins one day. Does he actually have a scar on his face? Fuck no. Why would you even ask that? That's not important. What's important is that he is not at all a problematic stereotype and that he has come for his cocaine. As he approaches the red rope of the VIP, pronounced Ve A Pay in Spanish,
oh my gosh.
He spots his dear friend, who is almost certainly going to become his enemy by the end of the film, Smooth Skin. Scarface yells out his signature line.
Ciao, Bella. It's me, Scarface.
Oh my God.